indicated that at least in certain regions by the middle of the 15th century, the din in the Ashkenazi communities were manned not by the Rabbanim, but by the appointments of the Kahal. We also saw 2 weeks ago that there were areas within the Ashkenazic community, certainly at the time of the Rambam, in which there was no Jewish autonomy whatsoever. So that sort of poses the scope of the problem that we're going to be faced with, and certainly I can't cover this entire period in one shiur, but I can try to give sort of a survey of what's going on, and then start to read some of the documented material, and then have to postpone the detailed discussion of many of these issues until after the break. We're talking about a period of Ashkenazi Jewry from, or French Jewry, or to some extent even Spanish Jewry, European, Western European Jewry, that is Jewry under the control of the Christian kings, from the period of about 950, which is the earliest records we really have of settlements north of Italy in Europe, in which there was some continuous residence until later times, and approximately the 1500. So we're talking about Europe, mainly France and Germany, also to some extent Spain and Provence, but I'll be concentrating mainly on France and Germany. Now, in analyzing what goes on in this historical period, one faces the fact that there have been many, many studies written on this subject, and almost as many different opinions as to what's actually going on. And I'm afraid that by the time I'm done with this, there'll be still one more opinion as to the analysis of what's going on. Just to briefly list some names of scholars who've done a substantial amount of work, besides the famous work of Baron on the Jewish community encompassing its entire history, and the famous work of Finkelstein on Jewish self-government in the Middle Ages, which brings us many of the texts, at least the Takanot that we'll be using. We have the work of Asaf on the history of the Bate Din. We have the work of Yitzhak Baer. He wrote his major works on the history of Jews and Christian Spain. He wrote a very important, seminal, and basically, in my mind, wrong article on the theory and history of the Jewish community as it existed in Ashkenaz. You have Agus, who also has written extensively on the role of the development of the Jewish community and its relation to the emergence of the city in the European communities. You have this article by Morell, which I'm passing out, which I think is more or less a summary of the standard opinions of Baer and Menachem Elon. I don't think it counts as a good work of scholarship, but as I said, at least it's available in English. There's a PhD thesis by someone by the name of Handelsmann. There's the work of Grossman on Chachmei Ashkenaz HaRishonim, and we will cite a good bit of his, of the sources that he cites tonight. Then there's a work of Yishai Yuval about of the developments in the rabbinate in the 15th century, and there's a work of Mordechai Breuer on the history of the Rabbanut. And there is this book by Stowe, a very recent book in English called An Alienated Minority, which also has to deal with this. So during this period, we have to remember that there was a steady deterioration in the position of the Jews. That is, whereas under the Roman Empire, the Jews were citizens, and were recognized as citizens and had citizens' rights. And in the Islamic world, the Jews were second-class citizens, but they had their second-class citizen rights protected to some extent by the Quran, by having judicial autonomy. Certainly in the Islamic world, their position, their relative position, ranged from the unpleasant to the intolerable, but at least it, in some sense it was protected constitutionally by the formulation of Islamic law. Within Europe, the situation steadily deteriorated. That is, starting from being citizens of the Roman Empire with well-defined rights, perhaps, as we saw, their rights to autonomy seemed to be, were in fact, limited by the Theodosian Code and other things. They had, in their initial settlements, freedom of travel. They boasted, for example, that we're not like the serfs who are attached to a fixed place, but are more like the knights who can go freely from one place to another. Then we had a series of edicts which, on the face of it, were giving strong judicial autonomy to many of the Jewish communities, the ones of Louis the Pious, the ones of Henry the Fourth, the repeat by Frederick. But in fact, that's only on the surface, because the nature of those edicts were not really to reinstitute Jewish citizenship, but rather to take citizenship away from the Jews, to allow them to have this type of internal autonomy. But on the other hand, they were now recognized as an alien corporation rather than actual citizens of the state. Secondly, their means of occupation were slowly but surely taken away from them until practically the only economic resource. Whereas in the 9th and 10th century, Jews were engaged in a large variety of economic activities, from viticulture to trade to money lending and so on. By the end of this period, practically the only thing that they were able to engage in was the money lending and related activities, outside, of course, the internal activities for the community itself, namely providing for the being a grocer for, or a shochet or a chazen or a malami or something like this. But other than that, the basic forms of economic activity available to the Jews was almost entirely limited to the financial sphere. They not only lost their rights as citizens, but eventually became servi camerae, that is, servants of the chamber, or put in more modern English, fiscal agents of the regime, so that therefore their importance to the regime resided precisely in their ability to raise money for the regime. Sometimes some of them had high powers, like being masters of the mint or fiscal advisors to the king, and sometimes they had less. But always under this restriction as to how they were regarded. They lost their freedom of travel. Remember that Marami Rotenberg was in prison for the last 7 years of his life because of his attempt to leave the empire of Rudolf and get out of Germany to a safer location. We were subject to murderous exploits, beginning with the Crusades. Therefore, the physical security of the Jews was always in danger, and steadily more so, the various riots associated with the Black Death, for example. And then finally, there were the series of expulsions, maybe starting with the expulsion from England and ending with the expulsion from Spain. And all of these expulsions were more or less at the whim of the monarch at the time that the expulsion was made. The Jews no longer were financially necessary to the king, or even though they were financially necessary, various religious beliefs or prejudices or hatreds overwhelmed the rational, normal behavior of a governing monarch in those circumstances. And they were impulsive in the sense that maybe a month before any particular expulsion took place, you couldn't really predict that expulsion will take place.
Wasn't the church involved?
The church was heavily involved in all of this. Of course the church was heavily involved in all of this, but I'm simply saying that, for example, from the, say, 1391, when the anti-Jewish pogroms began in Spain with a vengeance, and many, many Jews were killed throughout Spain, until 1492, there was a large Jewish population living in Spain, and essentially not expecting that the next month they're going to be expelled from Spain. And then at one particular juncture, when Ferdinand and Isabella decided, Yimach Shemam decided that they were going to issue this expulsion, the decision came so very fast that nobody was even really prepared for it. So what one is dealing with at the end of this period in Western Europe was a series of deteriorating external circumstances, that is, relations with the ambient society, leading to personal insecurity, fear for one's own life, and then simply not knowing whether you're going to be kicked out of where you've been living for the last 500 years or not. And in fact, everybody was kicked out eventually from Western Europe by around 1500. They all moved to the east, either to Poland or to some of the Austrian lands, Hungary, Bohemia, and so on, and primarily to Poland and to Turkey. And then, of course, we know what happened in the next 400 years. That is, there was a flowering both in Turkey and in Israel and in Palestine in the 16th century, and then disaster in the 17th century, so-called enlightenment and enfranchisement and emancipation of the Jews in the 19th century, leading to their murder in the 20th century. So I'm concentrating on the first 550 years of this period and trying to get some grip on what was going on internally, but we have to be aware of the external circumstances, and none of these external circumstances were without impact on what was happening internally.
To what extent was the collapse of Jewish citizenship related to the collapse of the concept of citizenship in general, where people became, there was more serfdom, there were very few?
Well, as I said, at the beginning, the feudal situation had existed, serfdom had existed for quite some time after the collapse of the Roman Empire. Nevertheless, the Jews in the 10th century, at least, felt themselves to be free men. And so what has to be assessed is, I think it's more of how this alienation of the Jews took place over the 600-year period, and I think Stowe's book is pretty good at describing the process. It's not something that one can answer in a short number of sentences. Okay. The second thing that we have to bear in mind is, since we're trying to discuss the issue of the internal state of legal affairs, what the Beis Din was, how things were settled, and so on, we have to have some picture of what the external situation was. So whereas under the Roman Empire, one had a well-defined and well-determined system of Roman law, all of that also essentially disappeared in the so-called Dark Ages, say from the period of the Islamic invasion, or even earlier, from the period of the collapse of the Roman Empire until the resurrection of Roman law in the 13th or the 14th century. And therefore, one has to understand that the conception of law, the way it was viewed by the typical non-Jewish person in the in this period, I have some quotes here in the last few pages of this handout. I don't know if I have enough for everybody, but let's go around with this just to see. Quoting from a book, an article by Baker and a book by Henshaw, politics, economics, ethics, theology, all these run together, or more strictly speaking, politics and economics are subordinate to ethics, which is itself revealed ethics, and therefore revealed theology. We're talking about the medieval conception of the law. Here, with the one and fundamental difference of revelation, the Middle Ages are like the ancient Greek world, and medieval theory comes nearest to that of Plato. From the ancient Greek world also, politics and economics were subordinated to ethics. And in the thought of Plato, ethics was in turn dependent, if not upon revelation, at any event upon a system of metaphysics which has its analogies with medieval theology. There is indeed a remarkable parallel between medievalism and Platonism, the Platonism of the Republic and the laws. For Plato, too, desired the control of all human life by a single wisdom, which for him was vested in the philosopher kings. As for the Middle Ages, it was vested in the clergy. The control of the family and property, the control of culture and education, of music and poetry and drama. Do we not hear the Middle Ages speaking when we read in Plato, the philosopher kings, how one feature they will erase and another they will put in until the ways of men as far as possible, agreeable to the ways of God? We believe in the sovereignty of law in England, but we also believe in the sovereignty of Parliament, and our sovereign law is, after all, the subject of Parliament. The lex, which was rex, the medieval thinkers, was a law which did not proceed from a human legislature. So far as it was revealed, it was the stern daughter of the voice of God. So far as it was natural, it was the inevitable outcome of the reason in man whereby he discovers the mind of God. From either point of view, it was universal and eternal. It permeated all of society. It knew no end of its validity. It followed that all human actions took place in a pre-existing and all-determining atmosphere of law. And of this law, because in one of its aspects it is the revelation and commandment of God, the church is its custodian and exponent. We can see that on the strength of this law, the church can supervise the acts of Parliament, control guild ordinances, regulate the keeping of international treaties, and inspect the workings of the royal administration. For all these are under the law, and the church has the knowledge of the law.
Substitute Supreme Court for the church.
There's a huge difference. There's a huge difference. But what we can see here, and we'll see it even more in the next quote, is Rashi's statement that we quoted at the very beginning of this shiurim, that going to a non-Jewish court is miyaker emunasa. Yoveinu pelilim, by therefore Rashi said, if you remember, that the prohibition against going to a Gentile court was because by doing so you give honor to the Gentile, to the non-Jewish religion. Religion, in and of itself, is manifest in the system of laws according to the medieval conception. This was not the conception in Roman times. Okay, here's another extended quote. Law. For us, law needs only one attribute in order to give it validity. It must be direct.
In modern times.
Modern times. For you and me, living in modern times,
this is non-Jewish
writer. Both of these are non-Jewish writers. I'm trying to give a conception of how the non-Jewish atmosphere, the views of the people, the non-Jewish people in the street, which undoubtedly influenced the Jewish perspective, viewed the notion of a law. For us, law needs only one attribute in order to give it validity. It must be directly or indirectly sanctioned by the state. But in the Middle Ages, different attributes altogether were essential. Medieval law must be old law, and it must be good law. Medieval law could dispense with the sanction of the state, but not these two qualities of age and goodness, which, as we will see, were considered to be one and the same. One, law is old. For us, law, from the time of its promulgation to the time of its repeal, is neither old nor new, but simply exists. In the Middle Ages, it was quite a different matter altogether. Age was then the most important quality, even of objective law. Not the state, but God is the source of all law. Law is a part of the world order. It is unchangeable. It can be twisted and falsified, but it restores itself and at last confounds the evildoer who meddled with it. If anyone, a member of the folk, or even the highest authority in the state, made a, quote, law, which conflicted with a good old custom, and this custom was proved beyond a doubt by the evidence of venerable witnesses or by the deduction of the royal charter, then the newly made law was no law but a wrong, not a usus but an abusus. When a case arises for which no valid law can be adduced, then the lawful men, or doomsmen, will make new law in the belief that they are making good old law, not indeed expressly handed down, but tacitly existent. They do not therefore create the law, they discover it. Any particular judgment in court which we regard as a particular inference from a general established legal rule was to the medieval mind in no way indistinguishable from the legislative activity of the community. In both cases, a law hidden but already existing is discovered, not created. there is in the Middle Ages no such thing as the first application of a legal rule. Law is old. New law is a contradiction in terms. For either new law is derived explicitly from the old, or it conflicts with the old, in which case it is not lawful. The fundamental idea remains the same. The old law is the true law, and the true law is the old law. According to medieval ideas, the enactment of new law is not possible at all. Secondly, law is good. Where we moderns have erected three separate altars, to law, to politics, and to conscience, and have sacrificed to each of them as sovereign godheads, for the medieval mind, the goddess of justice alone is enthroned only with God and faith above her and no one beside her. The legal philosophy of the fathers of the church was based on that of the Stoics, in which the theory of natural law, with its mixture of law and ethics, was handed down from the ancient world to the Middle Ages. And the reason why this philosophy found so much sympathy in the Middle Ages is to be found in the fact that the medieval thought failed to arrive at that divorce between law and ethics, which in modern time has been carried, by Fichte in particular, to the length of a dialectical contrast between the two. But while the contrast between ancient ideas and the living customary of their own world on the one hand, and the study of Roman law on the other, taught medieval scholars to work out the notion of positive law as something different from and complementary to the natural law, this distinction had no effect on the popular mind. The law, in its majestic and viable simplicity, seemed to the people to be one great whole, like righteousness, was God's handmaid, giving to everyone what is his own. Divine, natural, moral law is not above or beyond positive law, but rather all law is divine, natural, moral, and positive at one at the same time. If indeed all these differentiations, which had no place in medieval thought, may be introduced into the one undifferentiated, all-embracing idea of law. For us, the actual valid or positive law is not immoral, but amoral. Its origin is not unconscious. God, nature, ideals, ideas, equity, or the like, but is simply in the will of the state, and its sanction is the coercive power of the state. On the other hand, the state for us is something holier than for medieval people. At any rate, if the state is the one which we recognize and can love, which is part of ourselves and is our spiritual home. If not, then it's a different matter. If, for example, we repudiated a law enforced upon us by foreign rule or by the rule of the mob, then we become rebels against the state. But we are able to discriminate, and even the hated law of the most hated state is for us fully valid positive law until the day we can, by rebellion, destroy both together. The medieval conception is in complete contrast. Here the law is sovereign, not the state, the community, the majesty, the prince, or any other person or body which we should contrast with the law. The state cannot change the law. To do so would be to commit something like matricide. Law, which is identical with the good, is naturally prior to and superior to the state. The good old law is unenacted and unwritten. We are now better able to understand why the old law and the good law are intimately bound with each other and are, so to speak, identical. Modern law is always, in one way or another, enacted by the state. Medieval law simply exists. It was accepted by medieval opinion not as being enacted by men, but as being part of the just and the good, which are eternal. We remarked above that modern law is the law of the land from the day of its establishment to the day of its repeal. Previously, that is, before it was enacted, it was future law. Subsequently, it will be obsolete law. In both cases, therefore, it is not really law at all. Modern positive law never has the attributes of age and goodness. Neither before its enactment, nor during the period of its validity, nor after its repeal. Medieval law, on the other hand, being neither enacted nor annulled, was not so much actual as timeless. Only good law was real law, no matter whether the human lawgivers or judges recognized it or ignored it, no matter whether it were positive or only ideal law. The attitude of lawgivers and judges towards the law was only like a shadow that fell over it. It might obscure the law, but it could not set it aside. All good and true law was, according to universal belief, somehow already contained in the legendary law of a sage lawgiver, of a venerated and exceptionally wise and powerful king. The association of a law with a mythical lawgiver seems to contradict our assertion that the law is unenacted and unwritten, but the contradiction is only apparent, for the lawgiver is thought of not so much as an arbitrary lawmaker, but rather as a specially strong and clear revealer of the true and the good. God is the only lawgiver in the fullest sense of the word. The law reveals itself, so to speak, in the wise rulers of early times. Even they do not create it. They bring it into daylight and put men under its dominion. Even they, like all men of authority, are under, not above the law. But because they are in some sense prophets or heroes, they surpass the mass of the humans in their closeness to God, and as they possess superhuman powers, they themselves may well be venerated as makers of law. So we can see from this how, in the medieval conception, the type of world in which, of European world in which Rashi was living, for example, there was no separation between law and religion. If you were going to use the law of the Gentiles, that meant it was because you were accepting the religion of the Gentiles. The Aker Emunasam, the way Rashi puts it, was explicitly correct in assessing what the psychological impact and state was from turning from Jewish law to non-Jewish law. So this is a bit of the setting that we have. Let's see what we have for the rest of my notes.
It also indicates why this conception, like the Jewish autonomy, is much more of a threat than the Roman conception.
Of course. Of course. All right, next. The next basic historical fact that we have to deal with is that throughout the Jewish world, with the possible exception of, you know, pockets like in Egypt, and maybe still to some extent in Babylon, there was no longer any centralized Jewish authority. There was, in time of the Gaonim, as we saw, Rav Hai Gaon ruled all the courts within the Islamic world under his province. Maybe a couple of centuries later, a century and a half later, the Rambam ruled all the courts in Egypt because he was the one that appointed the judges. So there was, at least within the framework of Egypt, some centralized authority. There was never, during this whole period, any kind of centralized legal autonomous authority within Judaism in the Christian world.
What about the Rabbeinu Gershom?
What about it? Rabbeinu Gershom was a local leader of charismatic importance, a great scholar, and he had impact by his moral authority, but had no legal or judicial authority whatsoever. Rabbeinu Gershom couldn't appoint a judge in a town three towns down the river. He might, by dint of his moral authority, complain about something that they did. He may have tried to get various enactments enacted. We'll come to Rabbeinu Gershom very soon. But there was Rabbeinu Gershom, after his death, was given the title of Maor HaGolah a couple of centuries later, but he certainly didn't have that kind of recognition during the period, or authority during the period that he was alive. There was no one outside of the sphere of the Gaonim, and perhaps with the mild and also just moral but not legal authority of Rabbeinu Tam during a short period of time, where there was a recognized central authority. Everything was done by the community. So it's not merely that we're going back to a situation which existed in Eretz Yisrael where there was a conflict between the local community and the central authority. There was no central authority.
He recognized the personality that was overwhelmingly accepted by everybody, like the Rambam in Egypt.
The Rambam in Egypt was not merely recognized by everyone, but he was the person who was in charge of appointing the Dayanim. He was the Nagid. There was an official position created in Egypt analogous to the position of the Gaonim in Baghdad. Because of the political situation and conflicts between what was going on within the Islamic world, Egypt may have broken off from the caliphate in Baghdad so that there were conflicts there. But Rav Hai Gaon was in charge of appointing, or before him, the Reish Galuta, but eventually the Gaonim took that power over from them. But whoever, whether it was the Reish Galuta or the Gaonim who appointed the judges, and that varied from one period of time to another, the judges were centrally appointed. The two central yeshivot in Bavel ruled Bavel and, in principle, all of the outlying districts.
government assented to it, didn't they?
The government assented to it, the government recognized it, and internally the Jewish community recognized it. But there was no such unified Jewish community in the sense that there was a, and there hasn't existed to this day, a centralized Jewish rabbinate or a supreme legal authority which ruled all of these communities.
Was there impeachment of those judges?
What does that mean, impeachment?
Could Rabbi Goin or one of the other Goin change his mind and things like that?
Presumably, I can't cite a specific case, but presumably, yes, they could be removed if necessary from their positions. I mean, I don't have a case that I have in mind. He was accepted in a charismatic sense.
Yeah, that's what became the rule.
He was a well-respected authority. But as we saw very well, his rulings on many, many topics were overturned, both from the right and from the left, especially from the right. Right? We went through that when we tried to deal with the Shemitah question, for example. So, yes, so there have been from time to time great scholars who, by dint of their personality, charismatic leadership, stood head and shoulders above all the others, but even they had no official position. And when there was such an official position created, usually by the kingdom, by the monarchy, it was weak and rejected by the Jewish community. The Rav de la Corte in Spain in the 15th century was an impressive measure, essentially rejected by the Jewish communities as a whole.
Napoleon tried it,
for example, there. Okay, so our first problem, our very first problem is, how do we deal, what authority does the community have? How all of a sudden we have to come to grips with the question of, where does a small community, 100 people, 100 families, 50 people, where do they have any halakhic authority according to the traditional law? This is the very first problem that we have to face. No, that's not the Jewish conception. The question is, according to the old and good Jewish law, there was no such thing, no obvious such thing. It had to be reconstructed by the halakhic authorities of the time. So the very first halakhic question that we have to face is, what is the basis for the existence of an autonomous Jewish community that can impose its will on its members? If the Beis Din is not appointed by the Nasi, or by the Resh Galuto, or by some overriding central authority, by right does the community have a right to impose its will, its judgments on the individual? Who appoints the Beis Din? More to the point, does the community have the right to enact takanot, laws for its own self-governance? And if so, what rights do they have? Okay? So this is going to take us a while to work our way through, so let me give you a brief summary of how this actually took place. And now remember, we're talking about a period of some 550 years, right? Essentially from the time of the discovery of America to today. We're talking about a real long amount of time, and these changes are taking place over... Many, many changes were taking place over this time. But roughly speaking, what we can say is the following, historically. And of course, what I'm going to say now is a matter of controversy, because it's a question of how you interpret the meaning of the documents we're going to begin to read. Originally, these communities in Germany, which sprang from communities in northern Italy, were settled by people, some scholars and some not scholars, some Talmidei Chachamim and some not Talmidei Chachamim, but in the larger of these communities, the leaders of the communities were themselves, in fact, distinguished Talmidei Chachamim. So what I'm saying is, at the beginning of this period, when we have some records of it, there were some small communities which didn't have great Talmidei Chachamim in them, but many of them did, so that the community leaders were in fact the Talmidei Chachamim. With the advent of the restriction of and Jewish economic activities, there rose a class of extremely wealthy Jews who, by dint of connection with the king's court and so on, gained power in many of these large communities. So there was a displacement of the religiously educated, the Talmidei Chachamim leadership, by the rich Baal Kisim, as they used to call them, the rich Jew and politically influential Jew. So there was a displacement of religiously educated leadership by rich lay leadership. And during this period, maybe in many of these places, the Beit Din was still in the hands of the rabbinical leadership of the Talmidei Chachamim, but the Kahal itself, the leadership of the community, was now in the hands of the wealthy. The religious leadership didn't take this lying down. I mean, anyone who reads the Sefer Hasidim, and we read only bits and portions of it last week, sees the complaints about the change in the character of this leadership. And then eventually the leadership, especially for various reasons, because everything was getting professionalized, the rabbinate itself became professionalized in the 14th and 15th centuries. So you had the notion of a professional rabbi being educated, who naturally wasn't at the same level as the Talmud Chacham. So then you sort of had a three-way conflict between the great Rashi Yeshiva on the one hand, the really leading Talmudic scholars, the run-of-the-mill rabbi who was out to earn his living from the rabbinate, who was a professional rabbi, on the other, and the lay leadership. The position of the professionalization of the leadership then, by the middle of the 14th, the end of the 14th, beginning of the 15th century, led to various abuses of power by the professional rabbis, which was what we saw last time in the phrase Neskalkulu Adayanim, and led to their being kicked out of even the Batei Din in the communities in many of these situations. So that, roughly speaking, conflict of power internally due to external economic and other kinds of pressures, and then the professionalization of the rabbinate, which led then to the distinction between a professor and a doctor, and mutual animosity, and therefore a three-way conflict by the middle.
We're talking about communities of
small.
The
largest of the small community may have 800 families. We're talking about small communities. Worms or Speyer are communities with, say, under 2,000 something of that order of magnitude. Yes, we're not saying that these, I'm not denying these, the influence.
That's
well, yeah, but these are the facts. Okay, so now what happened? I had this one, can I borrow this? Okay, so first of all, let's quickly read through, there are two important shuvos that we have from the 10th century. One is, in fact, from within Babel, which is of interest to us simply because it repeats some of the things that we've been studying. And the other is the one that's primarily of interest to us, the sequence of tshuvot within the Ashkenazic realm. Okay. So this is a tshuva from Rav Hananya Gaon, who is the father of Rav Shira Gaon. So we can place this in the 10th century. Some period. Ushisha al ten. Ir shekavshua goyim, vehikuyo shveho lefi cherev, vesalfua ba'esh, ubazuzu ota vehechrivu. So a town was decimated by some foreign army. The ibdu ktuvotehem. Various documents were lost, including the women all lost their ktubot. They would take in the general devastation. The Chokair, the general custom in the city, b'ktuvotehem, pa'amim shemachan sot bin adunya davar murat v'kotvim lehem amon harvei kafli kiflayim b'masha hevia l'misha pasku alehem. Sometimes even a girl with a small dowry got a large ketubah. Apparently there were some attractions of women besides wealth, and they overwhelmed the size of the dowry that the girl herself brought into marriage, and the value of the ketubah far exceeded the actual amount of money that the wife herself brought in. So we can't tell, he's saying, the question is saying, simply by the richness of the father, what indeed, it's conceivable that you had a poor father of the bride, nevertheless the ketubah was large because the wife had desirable properties that went beyond wealth. V'yatayorenu adonenu chok hagviyat ketubah b'chayeha ba'al uliyachar moto. How do you collect these ketubot? Ben sha ketubah mitzuya, ben sha en shtar ketubah mitzuya. What should we do in the case that the ketubah is existing? What's the mode of collection? And what about if the ketubah is missing? Umata kana yesh la'asot b'ketubot b'nei hamdina hazot ba'mo'ora asher hikni. And what should we do in our situation where all of the ketubot of the town were destroyed?
Why is there an issue where the ketubah is mitzuya?
Well, first of all, let's read. Da, kol ma shetachnis ha'isha l'avet ba'alav l'nudunya, tichtevenu b'ktubata, ima shenoten l'haval mishelo b'moha v'matan v'tosefet yichtevu b'ktubata, v'yachal pi shelo natnula. All promises that the husband makes, all of the wife's dowry, and whatever presents the husband makes to the wife, together with the promises that he makes, are to be written in the ktubah. כיוון שקנו מידו וקיבל עליו אחריותו, מאחר שקונס את אשתו, עבד או נשרף או נגנב או שמכרו או שבלה ויחל את עמה, ואחריות הכל עליו, וחייב לשלמו, בין בשעת גירושין, בין ליחל אותו. In other words, whether the husband has actually delivered these promised gifts or has only obligated himself to devote them, whether or not the objects are in physical existence or have been destroyed, all of these things that are written in the ketubah can be collected by the wife. So that's the simple answer to Jonathan's question. But of course, that's not what goes on. Shekach kotev la kol nechasim de'itli achayim l'ketubate. All of my property is leaned, is mortgaged to your ketubah. As far as the collection in the case of a divorce, if it's the woman who institutes the divorce proceeding, if it's the woman who has instituted divorce, remember this is something that's non-existent in current Jewish law, but was common practice for 500 years in Gaonic law, if the woman institutes divorce, mishpata shenitol nudunya bilvad masha katov b'ktuvata shehivia mibeit ba'al medavia, she has the right to the dowry. Onosif ola l'ptula eswim v'chanisha ikar, or the 200 manak k'ktuvata ola manah u'grusha yudveiz v'chetzi, shlo utrola metchila ela ba'ev. Since the husband could not have had any marital relations without the minimum of the ketubah, then she collects all of the monies that she brought into the marriage, that is her dowry, plus the 200 zuz of the betulah, etc. Im lo yitein lo naset bi laptulah zinur. Aval ma shekatav la habal b'ktuvata mimatanot, im ma shehetvisa mishalo, whatever he gave her as gifts, including whatever she sees, ein not din la mimenu klum, he never made these gifts with the understanding that she was going to grab all the property and then leave. The achshav shemarda ein la baklum. The kevan shadavar came. The ein machaseret baala klum yishelo. Im ratzina de isha v'netratzet lo mutav v'im lo mishtalemet kmo shepirashnu v'kofinet baala ad sheyugarish. Explicitly, the husband can be forced to give a divorce and the woman collects the minimum amount of the ketubah plus all of the property that she brought into marriage.
No, I just can't understand. For 500 years, this was the law. How could it have changed? What is the basis for the change?
Well, we discussed this, you know. First of all, we have to accept the fact that it did change. The second thing, we have to accept the fact that this was part of the general rebellion against the Gaonim on the part of the Rishonim. Rebellion against Gaonic authority. Thirdly, this was part and parcel of the new conception that the Gaonim had no right to introduce anything that was not already in the Gemara. Remember, from whatever it was, 2 or 3 weeks ago, Rabbeinu Tam's argument here is Rabbeinu Rav Ashi Sofa law, so what right do the Gaonim have to institute a change in the marriage world? So I haven't completely answered your question, but the real answer to your question is that these are the facts. There was a 500-year period during, and the reason for this, maybe this is a better answer to it, is, as we said, there was Jewish judicial autonomy in the Islamic world, so on the one, and there was a centralized authority. That meant, on the one hand, the Gaonim had the power to enact these laws, and on the other hand, because they had the threat of the Islamic courts and the appeal to the Islamic courts and the appeal to the Islamic magnates sitting right on the other side, they knew that if they didn't enact these laws, disaster would ensue. Our current rabbis are unaware of the fact that disaster will ensue. And therefore, and furthermore, there's no central authority that is going to be able to enforce these laws.